equipment of car radios to include shortwave bands. There's a feeling that this will go in this country.
Well, there's still many areas, white areas in the western United States where they don't get adequate daytime reception.
That's true, but also I think that we may be seeing the beginning of a sincere interest in shortwave broadcasting, even in the big cities, in mm-hmm. areas where you do have alternative radios and lots of it, and television, but where you've developed a significant number of people who, for many of the reasons we discussed here today, listen to shortwave. And I can't say whether we'll be able to get the manufacturers of car receivers to do it, but I think for the first time there's going to be
very good.
An economic...
Good. Hold on a second, George. This is Talk Radio.
Information and helpful advice with WABC.
To join in the conversation this morning, just dial our talk radio number at 1-213-879-TALK. Now, just let the phone ring. We won't answer it until it's your turn, and that'll save you some money. The number again is 1-213-879-TALK. That's 1-213-879-8255. All right, let's take a call. We have Powell on the line from Columbia, South Carolina. Good morning, Powell.
Yes, good morning. I almost missed this show. Now, one of the magazines, that shortwave listening magazines, had been promoting it. And I have a couple questions to ask.
What station are you listening to it on?
WSB Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
It rolls in here good. I'm listening to you on my 1946 Philco tube type floor console.
How about that?
Because it's got a more directed antenna than some of than my other radios here.
Right. Well, now we have George Jacobs on the line and also Bob Grove of Monitoring Times.
Yeah. Some of the... I'm not sure. I've been reading reports on some of the radios and on some of the portables, even going up into the $400 range. Do you have a problem in high RF fields? Like sometimes I work at an AM radio station, sometimes I want to carry a radio with me, and some of the radios I've carried in there just completely revolted. They just did not like being in that real high RF field if you're real close to the transmitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a, let's say, brand name solid-state radio, and I was working at a TV station. I said, this is a real sensitive radio, worked great, until I carried it out to the TV station. Couldn't use it. Totally useless. Could not hear anything on it.
You probably have to build a Faraday cage.
What I did was I swapped it for a friend of mine for a National NC-183D. Which I still have.
Hmm. How did that work?
All right, let George Jacobs get into this because he'll give you the right story.
Mm-hmm.
Solid-state radios are more susceptible to that sort of interference when you're in a very high RF field. They will overload. I live about a mile from a 50kW transmitter, a WTOP in Washington, and they're on 1500. And unfortunately, they do knock out for me all the harmonics, 1500, 3000, 4500. And I put some filters in, and it helped. But, you know, that's an unusual situation, and it's a situation that very few shortwave listeners will encounter. But you encounter it on your AM radios in your car, too, as you go by a strong broadcasting station. It'll just overload and block everything out. But that is the unusual situation. And yes, you're right, solid state tends to be more prone to that kind of overloading.
All right. Thank you very much, Paul. Bob Grove, we're going to make way for another publisher who puts out a magazine called Popular Communications, Tom Nitel. And I want to thank you very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
All right. Take care now.
Okay. Bye-bye now.
Take care, Bob.
Let's now say hello to Tom Nitel. He's also in New York City. And have you been hearing what's been going on, Tom?
Yes, I love this program.
Good. All right, good morning to you. And here's another publication that I think anybody who's interested in the shortwave hobby, listening to shortwave, ought to be reading. How old is Popular Communications?
We started in 1982, so we're moving right along. And the magazine has been growing in popularity, and you can just see from the mail we're getting at the magazine and the response to our circulation that the propagation conditions are improving and the public's interest in hearing what's on the various bands seems to be on the increase.
What about buying the magazine? It's on the newsstands, bigger newsstands, isn't it?
Yes, it's sold around North America, and you can get it even on many newsstands overseas.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's also available in electronic stores and also by direct subscription.
And you, too, have selected English language broadcast schedules with the frequencies and the times.
Right.
All right. I have a question for George Jacobs here. George, a lot of listeners who are not familiar with shortwave think that they can tune in any time, any part of the day, any day of the week, and hear the station they want to look for on that frequency, and that's not true. Would you explain why?
Yeah, before I do that, I want to say hello to Tom. I've known Tom Nitell since he was a young man in knee pants, by the way.
I was a young man a long time ago.
Yeah, I write for CQ Magazine. This is my 38th year, and I'm not sure Tom was born yet when I started writing for it. Yeah, this is one of the, what some people would say might be drawbacks to shortwave listening. Other people might say it's one of the things that make it such an interesting thing, sort of like fishing. Shortwave radio doesn't come to you over the ground like AM radio does, or through the space like FM radio does. It gets reflected from a layer in the upper atmosphere called the ionosphere. It's an electrical layer, much like a wire, much like a mirror in some respects. And when the shortwave signal hits this layer, which is about beginning at about maybe 100 miles high, 60 miles high, and runs up to about 300 miles, it gets reflected back. And when it gets reflected back, it's sort of the distance it gets reflected back is sort of like a geometry problem. You can it goes up, it comes down, it looks like a triangle. You solve it, you see that each hop it goes up and comes down. Comes down at distances up to about 2,000 miles. That's the limiting distance from the geometric equation. And then it goes up again and comes down again. And sometimes you hear round the world echoes. In other words, it just goes around the world that way. And this ionosphere is primarily formed by radiation from the sun. And it is subject to variation. On some days you might hear a signal exceptionally strong. The next day it might be a little weaker. Another time there might be more fading than others. But by and large, with the high power use today, and if you're listening to a station that's within about 2,000 miles away from you, by and large, it does come in like a local station. And
We have a change of frequency. Say the BBC, which is on for several hours at a time, all of a sudden you'll hear, if you're listening, we're now changing frequency. Listeners in North America, tuned to, say, 5975, this frequency is leaving the air.
Yes, they're basically, when a station is on for a long period of time throughout the day, it has to make, for propagation reasons, about four frequency changes. There's a daytime frequency, and as you might expect, this frequency is generally high,
mm-hmm.
because the sun is up and the ionosphere is very strong. And this may be a frequency in the 15 megahertz band, or in the 21 megahertz band, or the 17 megahertz band. Then you have a nighttime frequency, and as you might guess, this will be a much lower frequency because the sun has gone down and the ionosphere has become very weak. Now, these frequencies are generally in the 6 or the 7, the 9, perhaps the 11 megahertz band. And then there are transition frequencies. When you go through sunrise and sunset for a 2 or 3 hour period, you generally need an intermediate frequency. So stations will change frequencies because of propagation. Now, I should also point out, and this attests to the popularity of shortwave, there are so many stations on the air that there aren't enough frequencies, and stations have to double, sometimes even triple up, and this causes interference. And quite often, stations have to change frequency because to get around interference.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, you will find that many stations will change frequency often throughout the day.
And that's one that example I made was the BBC to North America. In the evening hours, they broadcast on 6175, and then at 8:30, I think it is, that's Pacific time, which would be 4:30 hours GMT, UTC, they then direct you to another frequency, which is 5975.
Well, you'd have a better example out there in California, KVOH in Simi mm-hmm. Valley, which just rains down, by the way, over the hills and valleys of Los Angeles to such an extent that it's far better than AM or FM when you get into the hills. Their daytime frequency is 17775 kilohertz.
Mm-hmm.
Their nighttime frequency is 9495 kilohertz.
That's right.
And it's those kind of changes that are made. They're well announced, and stations recognize that to accommodate their listeners. Mm-hmm. Stations will announce the frequency changes. They also tend to keep their programming in hour or 2 hour blocks. so that they have enough time to bring you a complete block of programming, then make a frequency change and have another block of programming.
All right, Tom Nitel, what about radio pirates?
Well, certainly they've been in the news lately. I know that not far from where our magazine offices are, there was Radio New York International that was on the air briefly during this past summer and have made the national media. It's we have a column in our magazine strictly devoted to radio pirates. It has a very large following among people who listen to shortwave and the broadcast band. The stations are interesting and very controversial.
Well, they operate outside of the law, of course.
Well, they do, to a certain extent. Radio New York International, of course, was brought up on charges by the FCC, then the charges were dropped. So whether or not they were illegal is still waiting for further time.
Hold on. Guess who we have on the line?
Who do we have?
We have Alan Weiner of Radio New York International.
Oh.
Stand by. We'll be right back. Well, we were talking about radio pirates a moment ago. I guess we would say we have the chief pirate on the phone. He's calling in from Fort Pierce, Florida. Alan Weiner, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Oh, not bad. You were on an old rust bucket with your Radio New York International here a few months ago. The ship was boarded and some damage was done to your transmitter. Is that right?
Yeah, we had a ship anchored 4.5 miles off Long Island, and we were operating on a Honduran-registered vessel in international territories. And, our ship was more or less pirated by the agents of the Federal Communications Commission that came on board and ripped apart the station and...
Why are you doing this? You're operating outside of domestic law and international law.
Okay, well... First of all, offshore radio has quite a history. Offshore stations are currently operating off the coast of England now, Radio Caroline, and off the coast of Israel. The Voice of Peace is the name of that station. And Radio New York International is kind of like an effort of a group of people, including myself, that have consistently, for 15 years, tried to get onshore access to the airwaves in the New York area. And consistently...
There are no radio frequencies available.
There are no radio frequencies available, and to purchase an existing station would require, as many listeners might realize, millions upon millions upon millions of dollars, because radio stations, especially now, are traded and speculated on all the time.
But you were interfering with an upstate New York radio station, if I recall.
According to our, reports, we were not interfering with anyone. And
well, I'm sure, Alan, that George Jacob has some thoughts on this, and I want to get his mind on this. George Jacobs, as a consulting engineer, how do you feel about pirate radio stations?
It's a hard question for me to answer. As a consulting engineer who works with communication lawyers, I can only say that, the law has to be interpreted, and in that interpretation of the law, one has to judge one way or the other whether it was or wasn't a pirate station. But when what Alan says is right, there are no channels available in the New York City area, and to buy a station would cost millions of dollars in the New York City area.
But if we had people doing this off the coast of the United States, all around the perimeter of the United States, we would have massive interference.
That's right, and the law protects stations that are on the air from this interference. They have the right to have an interference-free frequency if they obtain the interfrequency through due process, and all stations that are licensed by the FCC has obtained the frequency through due process. Admittedly, this process is very competitive, and for everyone who gets a station, perhaps 10 or 20 other competitors lose out, but that's the system.
So are you planning on going back on the air, Alan?
Okay, first, just a clarification. Operating in international territories, we have the use of the upper end of the broadcast band above 1600, which is clear, so there are frequencies available out there. That's why we were out there. And yes, we are bringing our ship back this springtime, and we are going back on the air because we violated no FCC regulations.
Well, listen, when they come out to get you this next time, leave your phone number because I'd like to do a news story with you, all right?
Okay.
All right, Alan. Goodbye. I want to thank you, Bob Grove, for being with us this hour, and George and Tom Nitel. Tom, thank you for being with us. And it's always good having someone who puts out a quality publication such as Popular Communications to be with us.
It's good talking to you.
Thank you, Tom. Now, I think we are going to go to Invercargill, New Zealand, and that means only one thing. That means we have Arthur Cushion on the line. Good morning, Arthur.
Good morning, Ray, and good morning to your guests over there.
So how's everything in New Zealand?
Very good. I've just had some word from the Minister of Foreign Affairs, which will brighten your day, that he's expecting to spend $3 to $4 million on a new shortwave service during this year.
So that means you're going to have some higher-powered stations than 7.5 kilowatts, right?
Yes, and it's just left for government approval. But the, you know, the Fiji crisis really put New Zealand in the... various ministers went down to Fiji and couldn't hear New Zealand, and they realized that we were fighting a losing battle and we had to do something. And I think that's... And the League and... the newspaper editorials, there have been a lot of editorials. Since October, we described New Zealand's voice as a tin whistle of the Pacific. And, of course, the newspapers took this up. And I think it's battered the government into submission and think it's time to do something.
You certainly are aware of George Jacobs. Say hello to him.
Hello, George. Yes, I've worked with George during his time at VOA and still working with VOA. In fact, I had Warren Shaw from VOA out here with me in October looking at our setup here and listening to VOA from Invercargill.
Good morning to you, Arthur. I'm still looking forward to meeting you on your home ground in the next year or so.
Oh, that'll be lovely.
For those who don't know, Arthur Cushion is blind, but he works those radios faithfully and has done for how many years, Arthur?
Well, I've been with the BBC since 42.
You're an official BBC monitor. Now, what does it mean to be an official BBC monitor?
Well, I check the BBC programs from 6 a.m. to, well, that's 1800 to 1100 UTC in the world service. And the frequency is really designed to Australia and New Zealand. And to check their... I'm not interested in the program contest. I'm interested in the signal quality.
The quality of the transmission.
Yes, and then we send a report to London every week.
Now, you've helped out, I'm sure, the Voice of America in the past, right?
I do that. Via Voice of America, we send one to Washington every week also, and one to Montreal every week.
Mm-hmm.
And that enables them to see, through the computer, to get an idea of the performance of frequencies. And, of course, we often get telex and things like that asking for suggested new channels and what can they do when there's interference on a channel. Can we have a look? Because we're at the far end of the world and no one better off down here to look at a channel than us because there's 12,000 miles away and if any interference between them and us, we'd pick it up, really.
You've put out a great book that I recommend to anybody who wants to get into shortwave listening. The name of that book is?
The World of My Ears, which sadly to say is now out of print and has forced us to get into another publication, a radio